Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another incredible episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into my incredible guest today, I'm so jacked up about it. I want everybody to know that if you want to follow my journey going up Mount Everest, you can do so on my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And beyond just following my journey up the mountain, as many of you know, I've been out fundraising in support of my daughter who has epilepsy. We've got a campaign called Amelia's Everest, the goal to raise $29,029. We are more than 75% on our way to her summiting her mountain and getting there, which is very encouraging. So we're all rooting for her that one day she can overcome epilepsy. And as a whole, we can solve this kind of mysterious illness that affects the brain and seizures and everything. So beyond that, if you want to go in and give me a ratings and review, it's all about popularity. We have so many inspiring stories like the guy today that we're going to talk to, that it really helps elevate the exposure and what we're trying to do, and that spread the word around. Everybody needs to be inspired. So on that note, I want to kick it in. Today's guest is a former teammate of mine from the LA Raiders, Matt Millen. Matt, how you doing?
Good, Mark. How the heck have you been? Long time no see.
Oh, man. I got to tell you, I mean, there's going to be some reminiscing, and I want to dig into your life. You've had a remarkable, you know, as I was really thinking about that, I was climbing a mountain yesterday with Jim Mora, and we were talking about, you know, you coming on the pod, and I was like, literally, this guy's had nine lives of a cat. You actually went to Penn State, the Nittany Lion, and I mean, just really remarkable, and so we're going to get into kind of a life-threatening illness, which really made you, you know, kind of get to the front door of where you're going to go with your life here in just a minute. Really remarkable. I was really, when that came out in the paper, I was really feeling for you. But, you know, going back, and I guess I want to start with, I got drafted in 1985 by the LA Raiders. You'd already been there for a couple of years. You'd won a couple of Super Bowls. And now, you know, I'm one of many, you know, new faces that you probably, you know, saw that would come and go. You're one of the staples linebacker for the Raiders. And it was such a classic, classic team. It kind of mixed the old with the young. And, you know, again, I was on the younger side. And you had guys like Lyle Alzado and others that were on the older side. But just that blend, you know, with all these characters on that team. And you're one of them.
Well, you want to talk about characters, you talk about the Raiders. And they, we had them in, man, they came in droves. And back in the earlier days, like a few years prior to you, man, they were like, it was like we were Character City. It was funny because it was mostly a team that Al Davis had put together through not free agency because it didn't exist. Yep. It was just cast offs. So he picked up a bunch of guys who nobody else wanted, but still had some, you know, rubber left on the tires, and they played. And then he, you know, he augmented everything with the way he drafted. And boy, we were as good as there was out back then.
Well, there was a lot of talent. And I've said this before, you know, I can remember that first Raiders training camp was in spring, and we were down, and I was called into the huddle, and Plunkett was calling the signals, Marcus Allen, the running back, Cliff Branch, the other wide receiver, Todd Christensen, the tight end. Bunch of guys on the offensive line who would become, you know, all pro Hall of Famers. And then, you know, we broke the huddle. I went out there. Lester Hayes was pacing back and forth. And then I looked to the interior of the line, Alzado, Howie Long, Matt Millen, you know, just a bunch of guys out there, Mike Haynes, the other cornerback. And I was just like, if I ever died and went to heaven, this is what it would be like.
Yeah, there were great players, and we had all pros at probably, well, literally we had all pros at eight eight positions on that defense. And that stuff doesn't exist anymore. You just don't find that. Al was able to stockpile talent. And back then, well before any kind of salary cap or anything like that, you know, he afforded them because nobody really paid anybody. So it was a good way to keep a team together. And we loved playing and we loved winning. And it came out. It was a special time and a special team, special group of guys.
Well, the other thing that everybody loved is the camaraderie part of it, right? On those Thursday nights and go out.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Yeah, live it up. And, you know, one of the things that I always appreciate, and I'm sure you've got a story or two, but, you know, I want to specifically talk about you. And, you know, you've had this long, distinguished career. You play with a lot of guys. And I was just a guy that, you know, in time, I was a pretty damn good college player. I was a very average NFL player, you know, played 5 years. You played 12. And you know, you in terms of my vote and what you've accomplished, four Super Bowls, three different teams, you know, certainly would be worthy of the Hall of Fame. That was not my career. But the point I want to illustrate is, you know, it's the little things that people do in life. There was not a guy, and I honestly mean this sincerely, there was not a guy on the Raider team that was more an ally, an advocate, to get behind me and do whatever you had to do to be a voice, because you're one of the leaders on the team, to helping me make that team. And, you know, I was there, I was on IR, I was cut, I was brought back. All these things were going on with me, and it was hard. And it was just a hard journey to go through. But, you know, I always had this inner confidence because I knew I had the vote of the players, if that mattered at all. I knew you were one of those guys that was behind me.
Yeah. Well, so here's the hard truth about making it in the National Football League. So Mark, you had more than enough talent to be able to play for a long time and have a longer career than you did in the NFL. And there's a lot of different things that come into it. So you had your requisite speed. You ran great routes. You loved to play. You were not afraid to go across the middle. I mean, you had excellent hands. You had all those things. And the problem is, you can have a great skill set, and if you get there at a time when there is no other skill set like that, you're in great shape. And you can take off with your career and show exactly what you have. Or you can show up at a team like the Raiders when you did, when there was a bunch of guys who had the same skill sets. Some had already established themselves, and you're trying to scratch your way in onto that place, and it's tough to do, but you can see who's talented. It wasn't hard for us to see. You go, that kid can play.
Yeah.
But you know, we got four guys who are, two of them are going to the Pro Bowl this year, so that's going to be tough. Yeah. And unfortunately, that happens a lot.
It is what it is. And look, there's no sour grapes at all. And you know, when I to the Raider reunions, you know, it's just fun to see all those guys and Lester Hayes and Mike Haynes and all those
the judge.
Yeah, they treat me just like I, you know, I was like a 20-year pro and, you know, in the Hall of Fame. And it's awesome, and that's the way it should be.
You know, Mark, those guys, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit. When I got sick with this disease, it was shocking to me how many guys from our Raider team, it was an outpouring. It was overwhelming. They were like, they just came out of the woodwork. I heard from guys I hadn't heard from in years, but it's weird because everybody's keeping up with each other. You know, they're trying to keep tabs on you. Or they talk to somebody who's talked to you, or it was really amazing. It really was phenomenal. And that's really the power of a team.
Well, to that point, so I was drafted in the seventh round. A quarterback who, you know, Rusty Hilger, was drafted in the sixth round. So Rusty and I were always rooming together and getting in trouble together. And I mean, he was, you know, we were opposites, but we got along great, right? In addition to being quarterback and receiver. And recently, this goes back maybe 2 months ago now, I get a call from Jerry Robinson, right? Another one of your, you know, your.
Oh, yeah, JR.
Teammates, right? JR, right? Great player, played for the Philadelphia Eagles, then was traded to the Raiders, and was a fellow linebacker like yourself. And he called me up and he goes, "Hey, Mark, you know, I just went over and I saw Rusty, and I don't know if he's going to have another week." And so I reached out to Rusty and said a bunch of stuff to him, and And it's just that, again, that power, that network of guys coming together and, you know, just for, to have that relationship with Jerry and to have that relationship with Rusty and other guys on the team to be able to feel that confident that they can pick up the phone, they can call me and I can reach out. And, you know, it's when guys get down like that, it's when you see the true character of people coming out to really help and support. And, you know, at the end of the day, doesn't matter if you are Matt Millen, you know, big time football star throughout his life or not, you're just Joe Blow walking down the street. We all need it.
Because all it comes down to, Mark, is it's people. That's all it is. So, and so the bottom line is always this: in the end, we're all just people living, trying to get by in this life. And there's a lot of things that help, but the main thing that help people is people. It's not money. It's not things. It's not anything other than a person taking time to take time. And so I think once those bonds are established as a team, a strong team and a teammate, those are hard bonds to get rid of. They're there for a long time. And I saw that firsthand when I was sick.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Again, name of this podcast is Finding Your Summit. It's very metaphorical, as you can appreciate. I'm literally climbing mountains and summits. I'm going off to Everest soon. But
how the heck did you get into that, Mark?
Well, I was going through my own adversity. I mean, that's, you know, the people about going through adversity and finding their way. And, you know, I was married to a gal for 24 years and with her for 30. It sounds like you've been with your gal since college and you've got four wonderful kids. And, you know, at the end of the day, my gal, she's a wonderful person, didn't want to be married anymore. And I was just found myself, you know, like in a spin and didn't know which way to go. I was very stuck. And so I don't know, one day it was just like came to me and it was like, you know what, I got to put a big goal out there. I want to do something athletic. I still can't go back and play in the NFL. Those days are obviously over. And so growing up in the Northwest in Seattle, climbing and hiking with my dad on those lower mountains that you see around the great state, you know, I just put it out there. I did some research and found that no NFL guy had ever climbed the seven summits. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to be that guy. And it gave me a goal, gave me something, you know, big, hairy, audacious goal to go after in a very powerful way. I've been able to see the planet. And, you know, the further and further I got into it, the more confident I got. And but the whole main thing around that was that through the mountains, through disconnecting, through being by myself, through that serenity, I really found the mindset around being clear about my direction forward. And so while I never wish that upon anybody, my life has become super rich, nothing financially, but just in terms of the relationships, having podcasts like you, making me really understand that, you know, while I think I had a bad this situation, like we're going to talk to you about in a minute, and others that I've talked 150 times plus now on these podcasts, make my situation not seem quite bright as a light as I thought they were back in that day.
Well, everybody's got, and it's metaphorical, but everybody will have their, if they haven't already, they will have a mountain to climb. And it's the attitude that you carry into it and the approach that you take in carrying and trying to get up that thing and beating that mountain that counts. And so, and to further the point that we made earlier, the way you get with that through all that is through with people, because you have to have others, because if you don't have others, you know, you're sunk.
Well, at the end of the day, we're born as social creatures. And when you isolate yourself, especially when you have problems, it just becomes that bigger of a hole. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of different things in the recipe that help emerge people out of those places. But certainly the power of strength and power of people certainly contribute to that. So so I want to talk about this disease which affected your heart, which essentially shrunk was it your oxygen level or down to 30%?
So what happened was, so the disease is called amyloidosis. And it's a disease that there's no cure for. They don't really know what causes it. It's an autoimmune disease, and so it's one of those things that I never heard of or never even knew existed. And so, ironically, training and lifting and you know, getting cardio and all that stuff. My wife and I, my wife is a former gymnast, and she's looking at me right now, laughing at me, but she's always been in great shape, and she's one who likes to work out, and so she's very competitive. And so, you know how I am, I have to compete on everything. So we would be taking these walks, and we used to run, and then my back's just shot. So it just got boiled down to just walking anymore. So I used to walk this. It's a 5 mile walk that we do at home, but the end of it is going up a hill, and the hill is kind of a small mountain, but it's pretty steep, and it's about maybe a mile up an incline, and it's pretty steep. And so we would do that all the time, and we compete on it, and you know, and that little, she would just, at the end, she would make sure she always tried to win, and I'd try to beat her. And so it was just kind of fun between the two of us. And then, you know, it just got to the point where the first, when it started, Mark, I could feel something. I'd say, Pat, something's wrong. And then it got to the point I couldn't even come close to walking the hill. I couldn't even walk on flat. I couldn't walk 30 feet. And so prior to me getting to that point, I went to the doctor finally after maybe the first 3 years, knowing something wasn't right. And the first time I went to the doctors, they did some tests and they said, no, you're good. You're fine. Go ahead. And so I waited maybe about another year and I went back to the doctors and I said to my wife, something's not right. And I went in and they said, oh, you have a blockage or something in your heart. And they checked my heart and they gave me all these tests. And, you know, I woke up from, they went in, did a heart cath, and they said, no, you got, your heart's is, get the heart of a 22-year-old, they said, and do whatever you want. So I said, okay. So armed with that knowledge, I went out and kept on trying to train. And I'm telling you, Mark, I couldn't do anything. I mean, it started to get worse and worse and worse. And then I went on a 7-year hike, so to speak, from doctor to doctor all across the country, from Los Angeles to New Jersey to, you know, you name it, I was there. The Mayo Clinic up in Rochester, Minnesota, down in Florida, out to here in Arizona. I was all over the place. And saw lots of different people. And finally, at the Mayo Clinic, after 7 years of seeing doctors and getting to the point where I could walk maybe 25 feet and then I had to stop, they finally determined what it was. And that was down in the Mayo, down in Jacksonville. They're the ones who, I walked into a guy who that's what he specialized in, and they finally found it. And then it was a matter of time before I had a heart transplant, but I had to go on chemo. I was on chemo for 10 and a half months. And then
chemo?
After that,
why chemo?
The chemo was to see, there's no cure for amyloidosis, but they found that the same protocol that you have for multiple myeloma, which is another blood disease, it'll keep this at bay and put it in remission. And so that was the hope. And I, like I said, I was on it for 10 and a half months and I haven't had it since that time. So that's over probably a year and a half now. And I'm in remission still. We just had my blood taken not too long ago. I had it tested again. So,
did you have to do that. Did you have the heart transplant? Is that what you said?
I had the heart transplant. They wouldn't give me a heart transplant while I had, while it was the amyloidosis was, how should I put it, active, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so then once they were able to get it in remission, then they said my heart was too far gone. That's when I was working at like 30% of its capacity.
Yep.
And so then they, you know, I went in for, I was doing games and I was calling, you know, the Big Ten games and I went in on a Monday for a checkup and they go right upstairs. You need a heart transplant now, as soon as we can get a heart. And I was like, I don't need a heart. What are you talking about? Remember, I'm all right. I got the heart of a 22-year-old. Remember that?
Yeah.
So it was funny. We happened to be up at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester and they were telling me this and I told him I don't need a heart. My heart's better than your heart. And the guy go, oh, I see you have a very good case of denial. And he was right. And so I had to wait. And it took, you know, I went to the hospital. They put me in. I was in there for 100 days, which is really nothing comparatively to what other people go through. And then I got a heart and they did transplant and I was out 10 days later. So yeah, it's amazing what they can do.
Yeah. So let me just, you know, catch up here. So for everybody that does not know who Matt Mellon is, my former teammate with the LA Raiders, he's a broadcaster for Fox, Westwood One, ESPN, NFL Network, Big Ten Network, and CBS TV. And we'll get into that here a little bit later. But when they came in, and there's a couple questions here. So when they came in and you're looking at the front door of, look, you know, this heart is going to give out. It's just a matter of time. And so this is what we need to do, X, Y, and Z. But part of that too is once we get through chemo and we stop this disease from growing, then we actually need somebody else to pass, right, for you to get a heart to do the transplant.
Sure.
Is that how it works?
Right.
Yep. So
that's exactly how it works.
Yeah. And so I think where I came into the story somewhere in there was reading online about, you know, you're in the hospital, you're waiting on this heart. If you don't get it, you know, you're going to end up like so many others and not make it and not be here. And so when you have this, you know, you've been married for a long time to this wonderful lady, Pat, and you've got these four kids and you're at the front door and just really looking at your own mortality, you know, what did that do to really like strip things down? I mean, did that take you to some other new spiritual level, or did it, you know, was there some awakening for you, or I don't know. I mean, I've never been in that situation.
Yeah. That's a great question. And the answer for me was simple. And so I've had a faith for a long time. And so I became a Christian I'm talking about a Bible believing conversion Christian. I grew up Catholic.
Yep.
And then, so I always had a good knowledge and kind of thirst for it. But then when I went to Penn State and I got into the Bible, and then I made a profession of faith, that was in 1976.
Yeah.
And so from 76 until the heart, it really, you know, things were simple. And then when that happened, thankfully, I was actually pretty good. I was like, okay, this is the way I go. This is the way I go. At least I know it. And I was fine with it. And so I was faced with it, you know, like everybody is. Eventually we're all going to die. So I just, I was kind of matter of fact about it, and I was good with it. The only thing that, you know, really kind of bothered you was because of your kids and your wife and the grandkids.
Yeah.
That's about it. For as far as I'm concerned, if I'm gone, what's the difference? I'm gone.
Yeah.
So I was actually okay with the whole thing. The only thing, Mark, it was the weirdest thing. The only thing that really bothered me in that whole time was I had a hard time thinking that somebody had to die for me to live.
Yeah.
And that was the hard part. Like, I don't know why, but I wasn't ready for it mentally. And because I know when I went in to the hospital, I turned to my wife and said, I said, Trish, I'm not ready yet. This is going to last a little long because my mind's not ready yet. I know it. And maybe that lasted to about I was in there for maybe a little over 2 months. And I said to her, yeah, I'm ready now. I think I get it. Hmm. And then I finally got the heart. So it was a weird deal, though.
It's the waiting game. Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, you're literally waiting for somebody to have some horrific accident, or they just die of natural causes, and then, you know, line up where the heart matches the heart and all that other stuff, and then they need to actually crank you open and replace the valve with one to the other. There's a lot of moving parts there, and it's scary. And I think you said it right. And again, we're talking apples and oranges here, but you know, I've got two beautiful girls, 23 and 21, and you know, they are scared beyond you can actually believe, you know, for me to go up Everest, you know, for me, it's just like, hey, I got this. And, you know, on the flip side of that too, is if something bad happens, I can honestly say, I mean, I passed doing the thing that I'd love to do the most. And I don't think that's going to happen, but you know, since they don't have any control over it and they're the ones that are going to be at loss, not me, that's where all the angst and anxiety and stress right. comes, you know, on that end. Just, I'm sure like your wife and your four kids.
Right. Exactly. Right. And you know, we have 10 grandkids now, so.
Wow.
So you want to watch them grow up and yeah, you want to, yeah, you hear, and I'm 62 years old, so yeah. You're not old, you're older, but anyway, so the long and short of it is, you know, we went through it, everything has gone well relatively, and so, and I say relatively because when you're in the hospital that many days, you get to know everybody on that ICU unit, so, and that intensive care group is a different group, and so you see people that, and I walked, Mark, every day in the morning. I'd walk a mile and a half in the morning and a mile in the afternoon. And so I knew, I was like the mayor of the ICU. I was like the mayor of intensive care. I walked around. I knew all the doctors. I knew the nurses. I knew all the patients. I just, they'd say to me, what are you doing here? And I'd say, I don't know. They want to give me a new heart. I don't believe them. And I'd keep walking.
It was awesome.
And I'd have to walk. And I had, they put these drugs, they put them right in your jugular.
Yeah.
And so you're walking around with this pole and the medicine being dumped into your heart. And yeah. all they said to me was, they said, look, the better shape you're in going in, the better, the further along you'll be coming out. So yeah. I was like, look, how much do you want me to walk? Cause I'll walk all day if you need me to.
Yeah, well, if I was in that situation, I'd take that pull rep Mount Everest with me. Just
exactly. That's exactly right. So that's the mindset that you have to have, and that's what we did.
Well, I tell you this. I mean, again, just going back in my short time with you, and again, I've said this to other people over time, and that is you're probably one of the funniest guys I've ever been around who did not drink a sip of alcohol. Now, whether that's changed or not, doesn't really matter, but it was just impressive. You always had that very quick wit. And, you know, at the end of the day, these are my words, not yours, but I'm sure you brought a lot of hope and bright light to many of those that were in that wing that you're walking around with that pole that helped them, you know, get through their day, just some sparkle or some, you know, funny thing that you said to them.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the weird thing, Mark, I can find something to laugh at in every situation. Sometimes it may not be as appropriate because I have a twisted sense of humor, but it, to me, it's funny. And so, so there were some people that were, you know, really kind of, you know, people get kind of stiff with stuff and I'd be like, yeah, this is, I'm a pole dancer. I did all kinds of stuff.
It's awesome.
I made friends with a lot of people. Some of them didn't make it. Some guys, you know, there's this machine. It's a heart lung machine and it is brutal. I mean, brutal. And you're hooked up to it and you literally, it wasn't an LVAD. That was a, what the heck was that machine called? Trisha, do you remember? I don't remember what the machine was. All I remember is it does essentially, it's a heart lung machine. It's refining all your blood and oxygenating it, and it's pumping it back through your body. And it sits right next to you, and you sit there. And there was a guy who was in there, and he would see me walking around. And I'd walk, and I'd walk, and I'd walk. And one night, when I was in there maybe a month and a half to 2 months in, and he was laying in the bed, and he goes, so apparently they must have, you know, people talk, and the nurses talk, and everybody. So everybody kind of knows a little bit about some of the people on the floor, if you're there long enough.
Yep.
And so as I was walking by one night and out of the room, I hear, hey, football guy. I took another lap and I came back and he goes, football guy. And I stopped and I turned and I looked and he was in there. And Mark, I'm telling you, my heart went out for him. Cause I walked in and there, it's just weird. walk in, and the guy is a young guy, and he said, "I want to walk like you." I said, "Well, get up and walk. Let's go. Let's go for a walk right now." And I looked, and I saw the machine there, and it's nasty. Hmm. It's like, and so I don't even know. When I left, he was still in that. You can stay on them for a pretty long period of time, but he was a high. He was one of the guys who was a high priority to get a heart. So, but you have to have the right match, and so he was waiting.
Yeah.
So wasn't easy, but you know, I got to know a lot of different people in that hospital.
Well, like I said before, I think it was quite a blessing. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about when you grew up, and I'm assuming you grew up in the great state of Pennsylvania, correct?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Yep. Yep.
In the town of Hakandawa.
So in the town of Hakandawa, how far away was that to Penn State? And, you know, so I went to Washington, right? And we actually played right. Penn State in the 1983 Aloha Bowl. The might have been the second year over there. We lost to the Nittany Lion. But it was really cool to be around Joe Pa and, you know, the coaching staff and the other players. And, you know, there was such rich tradition. And it's really cool to see that they seem to be back on track after going through a number of years of serious adversity with all the things that were going on there. But was that always your choice? Is that where you wanted to go? Is that where you wanted to play?
That's a great question. And the answer is no. In fact, now, initially, I grew up, and when I grew up in that little town of Hakandawa, and it was a town that was dominated by two teams, the Penn State Nittany Lions and Notre Dame. And because you're inundated with hearing about Penn State and Notre Dame growing up, I couldn't stand either of those teams. Hmm. It used to drive me nuts. That's all I ever heard was Notre Dame and Penn State, and I was like, forget it. And so when I was being recruited, I got recruited, you know, nationally. And so one of the things, there were two schools that I said I would not go to, and you know which ones they were.
Yep.
And so when Penn State came, and Joe came to my house, you know, he drove down. He actually, the day Joe showed up at my house, there was a recruiter there from Michigan, and it wasn't the coach. It was back in the day, they sent guys, they just sent people. They'd send different alumni there, and they'd, you know, entice you with all kinds of different things. And Joe showed up, and the guy from Michigan was there, and they got into a fight in my living room. Literally, they started pushing each other. And they, before they came to blows, my mom goes, "Matt, do something." And I'm like, "Let him fight. Who cares?" And so I actually had to get into the middle of the two of them and push them apart. I actually pushed Joe Paterno out my front door. We lived in a tiny little place.
Yeah.
And Joe, you know, turned around and said, "Hey, sorry about that. I hope I didn't hurt you back there. You couldn't hurt anybody." And then we left, and we went to a friend of mine, and we sat there, and he gave me the whole spiel. And I told him, "Coach, I really appreciate the interest, but I am not going to Penn State." And that was the end of it. Hmm. I didn't hear from him. Well, they sent letters and stuff like that. And then he actually invited me to this one dinner. This is funny, Mark. There was a dinner that he invited me to right before the national letter of intent was to be signed, where I was intent on signing with Colorado. Colorado was the Big Eight champ, and they were putting people out left and right. And they were very gracious in how they treated you. And so I had no intention of going. And Joe got up and gave this very strong speech about, he knew I was getting involved with some stuff. And he said, "We don't do that at Penn State," and this and that. And so he was spitting that out there. And in the middle of his speech, as he was saying, "Penn State does it the right way," I stood up. There was maybe 300 Penn State supporters there. I stood up in the middle of all, and I said, "Hey, Coach, does that mean I don't get the car you promised me?" And the whole place burst out laughing. And Paterno Paterno stood up and he looked at me and he said, "No, Millen, you don't get the car I promised you." And everybody laughed. And I thought to myself, I'll never see this guy again after this. Well, the day came to sign my national letter of intent. My dad wouldn't sign it. I was only 17. Yeah. And so literally I signed maybe 4 or 5 days later. And I just signed with anybody and it happened to be Penn State.
Wow.
And that's where I went. That's how I got there. Other than that, I would have been out at Colorado.
Well, you know, I mean, all things happen for a reason, and you do end up going to Penn State in 1976. You're there till 1979. You're on some great teams, and I think you played all 4 years. And, you know, I mean, you know, it really sets you up for success for the future of where that would land you with the Raiders. I think you're drafted by the Oakland Raiders in those days, so you're actually in two different cities with the Raiders, winning Super Bowls, which is remarkable.
Yeah, it's funny how all that stuff works out, you know, because and so I went to Penn State my freshman year. I started after 4 games, and then we started the another friend of mine, another freshman and myself, Bruce Clark. We both started as linebackers, and then we started all the way through.
Played with Bruce until we got New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yeah.
Yep.
And so we were both inside backers. And then the last game of the season against Pitt, he didn't start us for some reason. And he played the seniors who were there, and which I understood. And then the next year when it came back, we went to a bowl game. And then after the bowl game, he called us in the office. You know, at that time I was probably 235 or so, maybe 235-ish, 240-ish. Our defensive line was so small, it was embarrassing. But Joe had a couple of rules that he had set in stone. And one of them that was in his mind was 260 is an all the weight you can weigh. Past that, you're too fat.
Hmm.
That was his rule. I mean, it was like, it was ridiculous.
It's an insane
and
rule.
So, yeah, it just didn't make any sense for big time football, if you're training. Yep. He did not believe in lifting weights. He conceded that point, and we finally got a weight. We didn't have a weight room. It was a joke. And then, you know, so Bruce and I kept on lifting. And, you know, we were 265 and he was like, "Yeah, you're too fat, Millen. Clark, you're too fat." I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so we lifted our way right out of linebackers and became defensive linemen. So I got drafted as a defense. I played right defensive end. And, they drafted me to play linebacker. So I only played linebacker 1 year because in high school, I never played. I was a running back and a fullback. And then on defense, I played defensive end and an outside backer. And then now I'm going to be a linebacker for the Raiders. And that was a heck of a transition.
Well, you're one of those guys too that, you know, you're versatile and you've got just great intuitive skills. You always did for the football. So it didn't seem to me like that would be that big of a leap. With Bruce, I think he was the Outland Trophy winner, right?
Bruce won the Lombardi.
Lombardi.
He won the Lombardi. Yep. And he won the Lombardi and he was, we both runner up for the Outland. And I rounded up to Bruce for Lombardi, which that was weird.
Yeah.
But we had a great team, and that was a really, really fun time back at Penn State. And so on to the Raiders, and, you know, and you just do what's ahead of you. And so what was ahead of you was take the team. The team when I got there was kind of fractured. And so on defense, as you saw when you were there, I kind of just ran it.
Yep.
I just took it over, and we had so many great players, but somebody had to pull everything together because great teams, as you know, great teams are run by the players.
Yep.
And those teams were run by the players, and that's, I think, was one of our keys to success.
No, big time, big time. I mean, you know, I had Gus Frerotte on the pod, a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that we're talking about is he played for quite a long time in the NFL, as did Steve Berline, who was on the pod. And I think one of the things that people don't understand is when you're talking about playing football and you open up the transactions, you know, in the newspaper and you look at the end, like, hey, look at Millen just got traded to the 49ers, or got cut, or got this or that. And they don't really understand the transition and how difficult that is, because you have all these buddies. You know, I was heartbroken. I was traded to New Orleans, and I was heartbroken to be split up with these guys that I got to know over 3 years and training camps and everything else. And I thought I was one of the guys. And then to go to a whole new zip code, and you're talking about, you know, you had an apartment or a house, and now you got a car, and it's just all these logistical things that you have to put together, and it's hard. And you just happen to pick the right team. So obviously you're with the Raiders, you win a couple Super Bowl, and then you go on to the 49ers, and then you end up with the Redskins. And in each stop, you just happen to make the right pick, or there was mutual alignment. But, you know, you walked away again with rings. And I mean, in each one of those cases, it was special, but I'm sure the transition going from A to B was very difficult.
You know, Mark, it wasn't that hard. It wasn't that hard for me, only because I was fortunate in that. Look, when I went my last year with the Raiders, I was, I went to the Pro Bowl, and I was playing at a really high level, and we had a coaching change. And when the coaching change was made, when I came back to training camp, I called my wife the very first day. I called Patricia and said, they don't want me here. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm telling you, they don't want me here anymore. And that was Mike Shanahan. And Mike did not, probably didn't understand. Probably have a do-over again, it would have been a little bit different. But he didn't understand all the things that I brought to the table for that Raider team. Coaches would call me in the offseason and say, hey, how did we run this? Because what we ran pretty much was a check with me. Yep. And we were so man heavy in terms of coverage, and the combinations of things we did underneath, we just directed it. Rod Martin and myself, or Ted Hendricks, and then Ted was gone. Lynn and King was there. And then Jerry Robinson was there at the end. Bob Nelson was there in the beginning. And the one constant in the whole thing was myself. So I just carried things over. So I got to, you become one of those players who know it inside and out. And you know your players, you know how you run it, you know how what worked in the past and what didn't. I kept notes for teams and quarterbacks and running backs. And so you just had that whole thing down. And when I left, I just took that to San Francisco.
Yep.
And the great news for me was, because I was released, I was basically a free agent. And so I went to a few teams. I had my choice of a few teams, but I felt like the fit was right in San Francisco. And so that's why I went there.
Yeah. I've got Ronnie Lott on the pod coming up in a couple of weeks, and excited to.
That's my guy. I love that guy.
He's awesome.
Ronnie Lott. Awesome. And so here's the thing, Mark. And I think this is important now, more so now than before. So I walked into the 49er locker room, and I immediately saw one thing. This is Ronnie Lott's team. I knew the Raiders were my team. I know I ran everything down there, but I walked into San Francisco. It would have been a huge mistake for me to try to do anything there. So I just blended in, let Ronnie do his thing, because it's his show, and that's fine. When I have to take care of something up front, I'll handle it. And I called everything and adjusted everything and got people up front and, you know, all that. But it was Ronnie's team. And you just fall in line. You don't want to step on his toes, because he was established.
Well, I mean, what it really boils down to is team chemistry, and you have to do whatever you can. And there always has to be some kind of pecking order. And if you follow that, then, and with great players, then great things can happen. And that's what happened to you. I want to move finally on to your broadcasting career. As I mentioned before, I mean, you've worked for all the big networks that are out there. I've listened to you many times. You're really good at your craft and what you do. You always bring great insight as the color guy. Are you still broadcasting today? And are you still broadcasting today?
Yeah. And so I just finished, I guess I'd probably 20 years already that I've been in, because I went to the Lions in between.
Yep.
And that was for 7 years. And so, yeah, so I'm still doing it. And it's a nice, I still do some NFL games for Fox on occasion when they ask me to. Other than that, I do the Big Ten games with the Big Ten Network, which is just perfect for me. You know, it's there's not a lot of travel, but and it's college football, which is a little bit different than pro football. It's not as much matchups; it's more schematic, and it's fun to do. And you get to see a lot of young kids, and every game there's something good to talk about, because even in a bad matchup game, there's some players that are going to be playing on Sundays, and it's kind of fun to watch them.
Look, I love college football over the NFL. I mean, I love the NFL too, but it's just the relationships and, you know, the youth and the enthusiasm, and you're still playing the same song and the cheerleaders wearing the same stuff. And, you know, you're not going to have Penn State, you know, relocate to another state. Right.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of consistency and tradition, which I love. And I've always loved that. And, you know, again, it's really,
you just cool. Hit it right there, Mark. It's the tradition. That's the part.
Yeah.
That's the part that runs deep.
Yeah. Yeah. No, look, I'm a Washington Husky. I always be, you know, purple and gold. And I love that about, you know, a team that I can follow from here to the end. And be a part of that. And that's what creates these great rivals, you know, across the country, and then that, you know, end up in bowl games. And then, you know, to match that and have great commentators really understand and know the game to articulate it in a way that we can understand, that everybody can understand, is really a blessing. And, you know, you've done a great job with really nurturing that career.
Well, I appreciate that. I just, to me, the game is, it's fun. And it's a simple game, but it's very complicated, as you know. And some people overcomplicate it. And when you can take the concepts that are being taught and are actually doing it on the field, and you can break them down a little bit and say, here's why, and this is what he's looking for, and here's how the receiver's trying to influence this guy, and here's the quarterback's looking here, and here's your keys, and it just gives you a little bit of insight into the game, and it kind of makes it come alive.
Love that. Love that. Well, listen, I just want to thank you again for coming on the pod. You know, I read this story a year ago or so, whenever you're in the hospital, and that, you know, this was kind of a life or death thing. And you know, I just really wanted to reconnect. I'm glad that we were able to do that through our mutual friend Hondo. And come on and just, you know, kind of relive old times. But I think it's important, you know, the power connection. You talked about that earlier, you know.
Absolutely.
Extension is really the key to life.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. And yeah, so like I said, money doesn't help people. People help people. And so as long as we can keep on doing that, we're in good shape. So thank you, Mark. I appreciate it very much. Good to talk to you.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much. He is Matt Millen. Appreciate it.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there, because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season, and inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.